I'm Jeff Booth, and this is Sex Science Sunday here on the Jeff Booth Show, brought to you by the Center for Sexual Expression and Education. Not a big fan of incest. If you believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible, then incest was pretty much your only option if you wanted to create a civilization. And yes, incest was more common in our past. But it has some downsides. We all know about the genetic problems and the importance of genetic diversity. But there's a new study showing that getting rid of incest, or at least kind of reducing it, might have led to something very important. The dawn of individualism. People in the United States tend to value individualism. And it's kind of become an important Western value. And there's some interesting new research which was published in Science by Joseph Heinrich, chair of the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology. About 10 years ago, he coined the acronym WEIRD, which stands for Western Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. Now, this term was intended to describe the characteristics of cultures that tend to embrace individualism. Up to about the Middle Ages, the Western world sort of embraced kinship and sex and marriage within families. And of course, that's long been an important part of royalty. But after the Middle Ages, the Western Church, which is essentially the Roman Catholic Church, they started banning marriages to cousins, step-relatives, and in-laws. Now, what actually prompted this change is not known, although it has been suggested that it might have been material gain. Religious leaders could benefit financially from shrinking family ties. They wouldn't have as many heirs, and they'd be better able to leave their wealth to the church. It's one of the reasons that priests weren't allowed to marry, because they didn't want people to inherit whatever that priest had. They expected his property and whatever wealth he had acquired, and you know, priests could get very rich. They didn't always take vows of poverty. They could be quite rich, and the church wanted that money. So here's what they concluded. Each additional 500 years under the Western Church is associated with a 91% further reduction in marriage rates between cousins. Now, Eastern societies still allowed multiple wives, but that didn't happen in the Western Church. And they believe that this change in policies dramatically altered family structures, and even the psychologies of the members within those structures. Kin-based institutions tend to reward conformity and tradition, nepotism, and obedience to authority. Once those kind of familial structures collapse, however, they predicted that individualistic traits like independence, creativity, cooperation, and fairness with strangers would increase. And that seems to be what they found. Researchers from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution have suggested that we kind of need to rethink the way we think about animals and homosexual and bisexual behavior. More than 1,500 species have been documented as engaging in same-sex sexual behavior. But despite this large body of evidence, scientists have really failed to come up with the answer for why this is so. But in this new piece, they suggest that the problem is that the wrong question is being asked. We shouldn't ask, why do they do it? We should ask, why wouldn't they do it? Now, you're going to think that, gee, that there's no evolutionary advantage for same-sex behavior. And yet, it persists. Why does it persist? Well, according to the researchers, it's because in reality, it doesn't really have a lot of negative effects. And there may be some important benefits. They write, we argue that the frequently implicit assumption of different sex sexual behavior as ancestral has not been rigorously examined and instead hypothesize an ancestral condition of indiscriminate sexual behaviors directed towards all sexes. By shifting the lens through which we study animal sexual behavior, we can more fruitfully examine the evolutionary history of diverse sexual strategies. So I point out two assumptions. The first assumption is that same-sex behavior has high costs because individuals spend time and energy on activities offering no potential for reproductive success. And the other assumption has been that same-sex behaviors emerged independently in different animal species and evolutionary lineages. And according to lead author Julia Monk, she says, If any trait other than homosexuality had been observed in such a diverse array of species, it would be widely accepted as being part of our ancestral DNA rather than something that evolved later. I point out something I never thought about is that some species have a hard time knowing who's female and who's male, and they just try to mate with anything that kind of looks like them. But they also point out that, if you are bisexual and that you mate with, anything that moves, essentially, you're actually going to mate with more individuals and increase diversity. Rethinking things seems to be a good idea, and we know that bisexuality and homosexuality are far more common in the animal kingdom. I remember reading some anti-gay scribe who was complaining that same-sex marriage is so disgusting even animals won't do it. Well, they do it. And I agree with these researchers that are thinking that homosexuality and bisexuality are somehow abnormal, when clearly the data shows us that they're not that abnormal. We really do need to rethink our perspective. Just as same-sex behaviors are very common in the animal kingdom, so too is non-monogamy. In fact, monogamy is a little bit on the rare side. And there is a new game changer, and that's DNA. And in a new study published this month in Current Biology, researchers put DNA evidence together with long-term genealogical data to explore questions of biological fatherhood on a broad scale among people living in parts of Western Europe over the last 500 years. What the study found was evidence of extra-pair paternity events turned up more often in people of lower socioeconomic status who lived in densely populated cities in the 19th century. The researchers say the findings support evolutionary theories suggesting that individual incentives and opportunities for seeking or preventing extra-pair mating should depend on the social context. Now, they use the term extra-pair paternity to mean multiple partners having your children. And here's where I might be a tad skeptical. They identified 513 pairs of contemporary adult males living in Belgium and the Netherlands, and based on genealogical evidence, they looked to see if they shared a common paternal ancestry, and barring EPP, they should have carried the same Y chromosome. And what they found was that there were no significant differences in EPP rates between countries, despite religious differences, but they did vary with socioeconomic status. Now, they found that EPP rates were about 0.5% among the middle to high classes, up to 6% for the low socioeconomic classes living in more densely populated cities. That just seems astonishingly low to me. Now, admittedly, it's not a huge sample size, and I don't really have the training to really understand this study, but it still surprises me. But it's interesting. And certainly I'd like to see more research along these lines, because I've always felt that when you were of higher socioeconomic status, it was easier to break the rules and have sex with more people. So I'd really like to get more understanding of this, and I look forward to seeing future studies. Childhood sexual abuse is a horrible thing, and we've certainly seen the damage that it can do. I'm not talking about childhood sexuality. I'm not talking about, where kids play with each other, explore sexuality, or when the situation is consensual. But certainly when it's forced and coerced and there are huge power differentials, I do believe that it is very, very damaging. And in general, the power differential between a child and adult really kind of eliminates consensuality. And of course, we've seen plenty of research on child sexual abuse survivors that shows us truly horrible consequences, such as depression and suicide. But a new study looked at factors associated with resilience and flourishing among adult survivors. Now, that's not to downplay the problems that many of these children suffer as they grow into adulthood, which can include chronic pain and substance abuse and depression and social isolation. There are lots of really terrible consequences, but what they found, and they were quite surprised in this study, which comes from the University of Toronto, is that 65% of the child sexual abuse survivors in their sample met the criteria for complete mental health. In other words, they were able to grow up and flourish. And that's still a horrifying 35% of them who don't. But I think what's important here is that survivors can be told, yeah, there is hope for you. The odds are in your favor. stand a good chance of recovery, and I think that can help with the recovery.